reach the
Hey everybody and welcome to the show. My name's Dave and this is a very special bonus episode of FFOP Radio. Why is it special, you ask? Well, I'll tell you. As you may know if you listen to this show, several weeks ago partook in the Beer and Bones event at the Arizona Museum of Natural History, got to speed date a couple scientists, and now I am lucky enough to have one of those scientists here with me today, in spirit, of course. So on the line here, I have paleontologist Matthew Wadle. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
It is, I'm super excited for this to finally be happening. I've been jazzed about it ever since we met at the museum, and I am so happy to have you with me, so thank you once again.
I've been looking forward to it myself. I had a good time at the museum, been looking forward to the podcast.
The last Beer and Bones was kind of a letdown, but to be honest, the only reason I went this year was because I saw that you were going to be there, so serendipity played its hand.
Well, thank you very much.
So first off, Matt, let's go over a little bit about you. You are coming to us from where?
I live in Claremont, California, in the Inland Empire. It's by Pomona, about halfway between Pasadena and San Bernardino.
Okay. So paleontology, what got you into it?
What got me into it is super simple. It was the August 1978 issue of National Geographic.
Really?
It came out when I was 3 years old, and it had a cover article on dinosaurs that was written by John Ostrom. And he was sort of laying out for the public all the new stuff that was going on in dinosaur science in the late 1970s. All that went right over my head, of course, because I was 3 years old. All I knew was the dinosaurs were the coolest things I'd ever seen in my life.
Right.
And it just snowballed from there. Most little kids fall in love with dinosaurs, and then most little kids fall out of love with dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. But for a few of us, it's a terminal disease.
Yeah, I have a mild case because I didn't go all the way into paleontology. I just annoy everybody with facts about dinosaurs.
Hey, I think that's, you're somewhere on the paleontology spectrum.
I mean, we're all on there somewhere. So where did you study paleontology?
So I was really fortunate when I was in high school to get to start doing an internship, basically volunteering at the Oklahoma Museum of Natural History in Norman, Oklahoma, which is affiliated with the University of Oklahoma. And then I went to the University of Oklahoma for college. And while I was there, I started doing actual research with Rich Cifelli, who's a paleontologist there who had taken me under his wing back when I was in high school, kind of taught me the ropes. And it was just sheer dumb luck that at the time.
Really?
Yeah. He had big bones from southeast Oklahoma that needed to be identified. And I was in search of a project. So.
No kidding. So what did those bones turn out to be?
Well, at first, we didn't think they were anything that special. We thought, okay, we only had a handful of them. Just four vertebrae from something really big. And we thought, all right, we'll try to get a very coarse identification, like to the level of a family, comparable to like a cat family or dog family today. And we thought maybe put like a 1 or 2 page note in some local journal. After about 6 months of work, we realized that we probably had a new dinosaur on our hands.
No kidding.
And then that turned into 3 more years of work and went into my master's research. And we ended up naming it as Sauroposeidon.
No, you were part of the Sauroposeidon.
Yep.
Holy shit.
That was my baby.
I'm glad I didn't know that earlier because I would not have been able to work up the nerve to have this interview. So you were part of the group that named Sauroposeidon?
Yeah, I was lead author on the initial paper, which came out in early 2000. And then we did a much longer follow-up paper that came out later that year.
Unbelievable.
It was lightning striking. I was a wannabe who got to be pretty much right out of the gate.
That is like one of the coolest stories I've ever heard. So the reason that drew me to you and to the Beer and Bones was that you actually co-authored an amazing book, Life in the Age of Giants, The Sauropod Dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Now, I have not been able to put this thing down since you handed me my copy.
Outstanding. That's high praise. I'll take it.
If I could give you more, I would, because I am in love with this book. Number one, sauropods, possibly the coolest family of dinosaurs ever.
Well, yeah, that's I think that's inarguable.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, as far as plant eaters are concerned, anyway. And I've just been leafing through this, and the amount of information and the illustrations and the pictures and everything, it just blew me away. So I number one, cannot recommend your book enough to anybody listening, even if you have like a passing interest in dinosaurs, something you should definitely pick up. Now we move on a little from you. Let's start talking about those dinosaurs. So Matt, what is a dinosaur? No, I'm kidding.
Thank you.
So are you a sauropod specialist? Like, is that how you define yourself to people?
That's probably the thing that I'm best known for. It's sort of the core of my professional reputation, I guess, in that all of my early work, and by early, so the first paper that I published was that first Sauroposeidon paper in the spring of 2000. So I've been doing this publishing for about 17 years now.
Wow.
And pretty much all of my papers were about sauropods until just 3 or 4 years ago. And since then, I've published on human ankle surgical techniques.
Really?
rabbit skulls. And I was on the team that named the little horned dinosaur Aquilops.
Okay, so that sort of leads to my next question. Favorite dinosaur? Everybody's got one.
Well, I'm afraid it's not humble at all, but it'd probably have to be a tie between Sauroposeidon as one of the biggest, most badass dinosaurs, and Aquilops as one of the smallest and cutest. But both dinosaurs that I had a hand in naming.
I was caught off guard when at the round table at Speed Data Scientist, when you pull up your sleeve and I didn't see a tattoo of a sauropod.
Yeah, it was Aquilops, this little horned dinosaur that Andy Farkey and Rich Cifelli, my old advisor, and Des Maxwell and I named. That paper came out in December 2014.
Unbelievable. Now, I've heard this described to me from other paleontologists, but I want to get your take on it. Do you see this as the golden age of paleontology?
It's certainly a golden age. Right now, two things are going on that I'm super excited about.
Okay.
The first is that we're just finding more dinosaurs than ever before. The global discovery curve is still trending very much upwards, exponentially. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, probably there were on the order of 2 or maybe 3 new dinosaur species named every year. And by the end of the 20th century, that was up to maybe 10 or a dozen. And now we're at 50 or 60 new species of dinosaur named every year.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I follow almost every paleontological society I can on Twitter, and the amount of discoveries that happen on almost a daily basis is staggering.
It's exhausting, actually, because as a pro, I'm expected to keep up with it, and it's like drinking from a fire hose.
Oh, no doubt.
which is a good problem. If you like dinosaurs, this is a golden age. But what's super exciting to me is not just that we're getting so many new dinosaurs, which are opening up new things about their evolution and their adaptations, but we're getting new information about their lives. Mm-hmm. Things like burrowing dinosaurs, which nobody predicted. Actually, most people predicted against. All of the cool stuff that we're getting about feathers and soft tissue, even flat-headed duckbills. Now some of them turn out to have had a little soft tissue crest on top of their head. So we're getting things that are surprising, like extremely surprising. And that's pretty awesome if you're a scientist.
Yeah, that's something that always has interested me, because all we have is the bones, and what we get are paleo artist reconstructions of these animals. But it's impossible to tell cartilaginous material or like anything beyond the bones. So the fact that more and more of these, to use a pejorative term, dinosaur mummies are showing up, I shudder to think that as Cope and Marsh were blowing apart mountains 100 years ago, all the stuff, all the soft tissue that could possibly have been lost, they weren't able to recognize it. They hired these people who had no idea what they're doing, and they're just pulling out the bones. So I'm excited to see more of that coming out, because that's what people want. Like, they want to know what these things look like, because it's one thing to look at bones in a museum and say, wow, you know, you get a sort of an idea of the size and the scale and whatnot. But as far as like color covering, you know, any sort of extraneous appendages, we're all still pretty much in the dark.
Yeah, it's better for some than for others. Like duckbill dinosaurs, with all the mummified duckbills and all the skin we've got preserved, we don't know the color. But other than that, we pretty much know what those guys look like.
Right, which is amazing.
Yeah, and then for sauropods, we're kind of stuck. I mean, we have a few patches of skin. We have a patch of scales, little triangle sort of sawtoothed fin-like scales on the top of the tail from Diplodocus from one site, or there was probably a lot more, but as you said, when the site was first excavated, people didn't know what they were looking for. Probably a lot of it got trashed.
Right.
And one thing that entrances me is, all right, we have enough skin impressions from sauropods to know that they weren't completely covered with feathers.
Okay.
But elephants aren't completely covered with fur, but that doesn't mean they don't have any hair at all.
True.
And certainly they came from hairy ancestors. So that's the interesting question for me is some of these dinosaurs that we know as adults were naked skinned. Okay, they weren't feathery, but you can have feathers without being completely covered by them.
Yeah,
and that's a really tantalizing possibility.
As a lifelong dinosaur fanatic, when the idea of feathers started floating around, I at first was resistant because I didn't want the image of these dinosaurs in my mind to change. And so, in your opinion, how many dinosaurs actually had either feathers or protofeathers or quills or something along those lines?
I think it was a lot. I mean, we know from on the theropod side, basically everything from megalosaurs on up had the potential to be pretty much completely covered in feathers.
Right.
And not just little guys either. Big things like Eutyrannus that's 30 feet long, totally decked out from head to tail in these big feathers the size of your hand. And then you've got these weird things turning up on the Ornithischian side, like Coulindodromius and Tianulong, that also have some kind of dino fuzz, proto feathers. We don't know what the homologies are yet. Are these just elongated scales? But it's pretty interesting that we're getting so many of these things. And what sort of intellectually excites me about this is the arrow of history. We're never going to have fewer feathered dinosaurs than we have now. We're only going to have more of them.
Right.
All the future is going to bring us is more surprises. So if people are, because I know there's still people who are resistant to dinosaur feathers, and they're like, all right, well, at least we haven't found any feathers in this group. It's like, right. Well, hold on, bud. You know, give it 10 years. Let's see where we are.
I'm in equal parts excited and equal parts sort of bummed out because I don't want to imagine like these big killer theropods with like fuzzy bodies. It just sort of undercuts the.
Oh, for me, not at all. And it may be because I grew up on a farm with chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Birds are mean as hell.
True.
And once you've been flogged by a rooster or you've had some little songbird dive bomb your head and slash your scalp open.
Right.
Then think about applying that attitude to a theropod. And suddenly the idea of Velociraptor and Deinonychus taking down much bigger herbivores seems pretty plausible.
Is there evidence of feathers dating back all the way to the Triassic, or is this something that picked up during the middle to late time periods?
Well, that's an interesting question because it has to do with what we think the homologies are.
Mm-hmm.
Probably for theropods, even given what we know now, and even if the things in the other lineages turned up all by themselves, for theropods are probably there by the early Jurassic at the very latest. And then if the stuff that we're seeing in early theropods or early-ish, things like Sciuramimus, this megalosaur, if they're homologous, if they're part of the same evolutionary progression as the dino fuzz that we see in some Ornithischians, then it probably goes back to the origin of dinosaurs in the Triassic. And then you've got fuzz on pterosaurs, too. Now, there are certainly papers out there that make a pretty strong case that a lot of these things were arising independently and in parallel in these different lineages.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing that, I think, at least in part, on the basis of preserved scaly skin on things in the middle. But unless you have like a complete map of the skin of the whole animal, which we have for virtually none of these things, then to me, you're back to the question, all right, these things weren't feathery, but does that mean they didn't have any feathers at all? Because a lot of animal lineages will have their naked members, you know, like ostriches don't have feathers on their legs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you could get a skin impression from an ostrich from the knee down that doesn't have any feathers.
That's right. Yeah, it's so interesting and also I'm sure frustrating having all of these theories but not the physical material to back anything up 100% yet.
That is the tantalizing prospect that motivates most of my research is, all right, nature has given you a part of a skeleton that's been left out in the rain for 150 million years. How much can you infer about that animal, its soft tissue, its way of life, based on what you have left? You can look at muscle scars and look at animals that are alive today, like birds and crocs, try to infer what their muscles were like. You can look for traces of air sacs on their bones. Sometimes we get lucky and we get preserved cartilage. And so it's a big game of connect the dots. And I think, I suppose to some people that probably sounds like my job is just bullcrap. I'm just making this stuff up. But as long as you're honest about your level of uncertainty, you know, if you have a big preserved cartilage cap in one animal and you have the same sort of rough attachment for it in another one, then even if it's not preserved, you can be like, it kind of looks like this thing was probably here.
Yeah, there's logical inferences to be made.
Yeah, so that's sort of my ambition, is how far can we push the envelope based on the trashed remains that Mother Nature gives us?
Right. Now, speaking sort of historically, I'm sure you've been, you know, following this as closely as I have, but the Brontosaurus. So discovered back in 1870-something, I can't remember exactly.
79 was Brontosaurus.
79. Essentially discounted as a species by 1903.
Yep.
But it still persisted, and now, so many years later, we may actually have the Brontosaurus back. So what are your feelings on that?
I think it's justified. I think that, so it was Elmer Riggs in 1903, mm-hmm. or 4-ish, who said, look, these things, Apatosaurus named in 1877, Brontosaurus named in 1879, they look very similar, way more similar to each other than all these other weirdos were coming up with, like Diplodocus and Camarasaurus and Barosaurus, Haplocanthosaurus. Mm-hmm. So we should just put them in the same genus and call them all Apatosaurus. And so scientifically, that was proposed, I think in 1903 or 4, and it was pretty much universally accepted by the 19-teens or the early 1920s at the latest.
So am I remembering this correctly? Is because I there was a misplaced head, and I believe, wasn't it the head of a Camarasaurus that they put?
Yeah, so that is a separate thing that is related, but in that it also deals with Apatosaurus, but it gets conflated with the naming thing. Actually, it's totally separate.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, so this sort of gets into this timeline where scientists had accepted that Brontosaurus should be lumped into Apatosaurus by the 1920s at the very latest.
Mm-hmm.
But the name persisted. The name Brontosaurus persisted in the popular landscape in, you know, kids' dinosaur books and things like that, probably well into the 70s, I would say.
Oh, even into the 80s, because I you know, was born around then and could not get my hands on enough dinosaur books. And they always had that classic, well, I can't remember his name, but he did that mural of the Apatosaurus and the Brontosaurus and everybody sort of feeding and grazing that's in that.
Oh, Zellinger. Rudolph, yes. Zellinger's mural that's at Yale. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that was from Life magazine from the 1950s, and that was hugely influential. So you had, by the 80s, 70s and 80s, you have this weird situation going on where, in terms of paleontological science, which at that time, you know, was much less actively engaged with the popular imagination, with pop culture, than it is now.
Right.
People were popularly fascinated by dinosaurs, but there just weren't as many links being forged between what we might call geek culture now and working paleontologists. People weren't doing what we're doing right now, having this podcast.
Yeah.
So you've got sort of these two different worlds, and in one of these worlds, Brontosaurus is still a thing. And then in the 70s and 80s, it starts to leak into the popular consciousness only about 6 decades late that, oh, wait, Brontosaurus, you know, we got to put that away. We got to be serious here.
Yeah.
It's Apatosaurus. But what's also going on at the same time, and especially accelerating through the 90s and into the 2000s, is we're getting more specimens of these things, and we're getting more data. And it's starting to look like, well, wait a second. These things seem to fall into two distinct groups, and we can kind of tell them apart.
So I guess my big question regarding Brontosaurus is it – because the articles that I've read are sort of on the fence about they may not. But recently they took the original holotype and I think used LIDAR on them to highlight and accentuate the differences between them. So are we – at that point, we're like, hey, yeah, Brontosaurus is a thing, or are there still some pieces hanging out?
I mean, the name has been resurrected in print. Now,
right.
I think what probably one of the biggest disjuncts between the way paleontologists see names and the way people who are popularly interested in dinosaurs see names is, to paleontologists, all the names are hypotheses.
Right.
If hypothesis gets replaced for a while or sinks, that's not the end of the world. We're mostly referring to these things by their specimen numbers anyway. And we realize that putting them into these fairly artificial human categories like species and genera and families satisfies our need to classify things, but it may not completely represent the actual reality of their genealogy.
Yeah.
But then, it completely understandably, people just want to know, what do I call this damn dinosaur?
Right.
Like the famous skeleton at the American Museum, this paper that split Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus back apart 2 years ago said this thing in New York, this famous skeleton that's probably been seen by about as many people as anything, it doesn't seem to fit into either one and it needs to be studied more.
Oh,
well, that's
wow.
A pretty unsatisfying thing when somebody goes to the museum and they just want to know, what do I call the frickin' dinosaur? It's like, well, it might be Apatosaurus, it might be Brontosaurus, or it might be some other third thing that we haven't figured out yet, and it's going to take more time. That is a complicated answer that gives you a window into how science actually works, but I can see why it would be frustrating and unsatisfying for people who just want to know, what is this frickin' thing?
It's staggering to think, of all the species we have today, there was never a time in the Earth's history where animals were out there that the environment wasn't robust with different life forms. So I think a lot of times when people are thinking about dinosaurs, they think, oh, well, they had the Earth all themselves. But there was insects, mammals, crustaceans. Like the world still went on as it always does.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a huge driver of research these days. Actually, I'm going to be out in the Oklahoma Panhandle next week trying to help answer that question. Is people went out there in the 1930s to get big dinosaurs to fill the museum, and they specifically did not spend a lot of time in the quarries that didn't produce big bones. What do you get in those other quarries? You get things like crocodiles and turtles and garfish. Mm-hmm. And maybe if we screen wash, there's a chance we'll find mammals. We might find lizards. And we'll fill out the rest of the ecology. So, yeah, we know what the big guys look like. We've known that for a while. And it's still, you know, that's still an important side of paleontology. But filling in all the whole rest of the world, the ecology, what's going on with these things? That's tremendously exciting, too.
Every time something comes out that is even tangentially related to dinosaurs, you know, you think, oh, wow, you know, this is, well, for, okay, so if you're into dinosaurs, I can't think of another more boring field of study than paleobotany, because to look at a time period where giant monsters roam the earth and be like, yeah, I'm going to check out those plants is, you know, whatever. But the moral of the story is, like, the work that they're doing is still somewhat captivating when you place it alongside these giants of pop culture, science, whatever.
Well, hey, to steer it back to the book that you were praising, look at the later chapters. And this is stuff that was entirely Mark Hallett bringing this to the table. I'm mostly interested in these animals from the skin in sort of an anatomical biomechanical sense. And he is really, really grounded and knowledgeable in things like paleobotany, things like community ecology and how predator and prey interact. And so there's a lot in that book that was him sort of opening up what the world of these things was like in a way that I couldn't have done. So in that sense, it was a wonderful collaboration.
Yeah, in those later chapters, it is interesting because you don't think, because in most people's minds, when they think of sauropod, long neck, brontosaurus, brachiosaurus, apatosaurus type dinosaurs, you think, oh, they were, once they got to a certain size, they were just like no longer worrying about a thing. But now that we're learning more that these theropods are hunting in packs, it's interesting to think of a pack of Majungasaurus or something of that ilk taking down one of these giants.
Yeah, so what that instantly puts me in mind of is the African plains, where 99% of the time, lions just don't mess with elephants unless they're really, you know, filling their Wheaties and they go try to knock off a baby or something. But definitely they don't ever attack a full-grown elephant. And yet, occasionally, when there's a bad year and everybody's starving, the lions will band together and attack full-grown elephants. So, yeah, I mean, a really big late Jurassic predator, something like a big Torvosaurus or Sauropaganax, might have been like 5 tons or 8 tons. But if you put that thing up against a 30-ton Apatosaur or a 40-ton Brachiosaur, it's probably just going to get pulped.
Yeah, no doubt.
If there's a bad year, maybe these predators are looking at each other and looking at this 30-ton Apatosaur and thinking, eh, we're hungry enough. Let's give that a shot. To say that that never, ever happened across 8 million years and half a continent of the Morrison Formation is ridiculous. Of course it happened.
That's the thing. There's a lot of hypotheses being made by paleontologists, and you're like, what? Because you see animals acting certain ways today, and those aren't new behaviors. Like, these aren't things that sprung up, like, over the last 10,000, 20,000 years or so. I mean, animals have always,
Animals do weird stuff. And I think that, and there's a little bit of, I guess, arguments, discussions going on in paleo art right now about that sort of thing, because somebody will draw a dinosaur, paint a dinosaur doing something unusual, and dinosaur fans will be like, oh, they weren't in that environment. And it's like, well, dude, they probably were. The elephant footprints have been found in glacial snow up on Mount Kilimanjaro at 15,000 feet. So if you paint an elephant, a modern African elephant, standing on a glacier, that's a totally legit thing that they actually do. They've been found swimming miles out to sea, far from any sight of land, in no distress, because you're an elephant, you can just freaking do that.
Yeah.
So they go into caves and they, you know, dig salt out of the walls of caves with their tusks. They do all this weird stuff. And there's no reason to think that dinosaurs were any less complex and sophisticated. They were around for a long time. They covered the whole Earth. Of course they had all these weird things going on.
Especially, okay, so you look at like the migration patterns of like wildebeest and stuff. This is huge packs of animals moving all over Africa. This, the similarity to dinosaurs is like, let's say the Pachyrhinosaurus.
Yeah.
So they went from Alaska all the way down to, like, I think, what was the lowest I read? Texas they were?
Ooh, I don't know if Pachyrhinosaurus made it down to Texas. Definitely they got down into the lower 48.
Yeah, moral of the story is they were going, you know, thousands of miles in search of who knows what, food, like better weather. That's something you can't imagine, thousands of these 4 or 5 ton animals just running all over, you know, everywhere, essentially.
Yeah, the closest thing that we would have as an analogy would be something like bison on the Great Plains.
Right.
Before they all got wiped out. And even that was kind of a weird ecology because so many of the big grazers had died out at the end of the Ice Age, like mammoths. So there are these, I think we have a very highly skewed view of what a normal, healthy ecosystem looks like.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Because most of us have just never seen it.
Yeah.
Even East Africa, the Serengeti, you know, there was a rinderpest epidemic in the late 1800s that wiped out lots of animals. I don't think it drove any of them to extinction. But there's been gradual and increasing human pressures there for centuries. And, you know, when we, you know, somebody will draw or paint a dinosaur scene that's jam-packed with dinosaurs. And a lot of times the comment, which is often a compliment, is, you know, it looks like the Serengeti only with dinosaurs. That may be the low end of what a really productive Mesozoic ecosystem was like. Because there was a lot more carbon dioxide. It was, you know, it was a greenhouse Earth. Plant productivity was probably off the charts. And you could sustain big herds of 4 and 5 ton animals if you're in the Cretaceous, and big groups of 30 and 40 ton animals in the Jurassic.
It's such an interesting thing to, like, just as a thought experiment, because every time you see, I guarantee 99 times out of 100, when you see a picture of a dinosaur scene where it's highlighting a species or whatever, see one or two dinosaurs, maybe one or two different species, but that reflects a fantasy world. Like,
right. That's what our modern, I mean, for all intents and purposes, most of our world for animals is a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Right.
Almost everything's been wiped out. Occasionally you get, you know, these sort of local blooms of things that can still manage to make it. But a lot of times those blooms are happening because they're no longer regulated by their predators. And, yeah, I think that a fully functioning, hyperproductive ecosystem would look extremely strange to our eyes because we've never gotten to see that.
A wild thing to think about, because when you picture dinosaurs, you think, oh, there's one or two hanging out over there, and then it's just like a forest or a desert or whatever. But, so moving back toward the sauropods a little bit, what is the size range of sauropods?
So they're at the low end. There are island dwarfs. So a lot of times when big animals get stranded on islands, they evolve to small body size. Mm-hmm. Elephants famously do this. So during the Ice Age on islands in the Mediterranean, there were elephants that were about the size of a really big dog. They were tiny, tiny little things. We don't know of any sauropods quite that small, but there's definitely evidence from Europe, both in the Jurassic with Europasaurus, in the Cretaceous, I think with Magyarosaurus, that there were these island dwarf sauropods. We're probably about the size of a big draft horse, like a Clydesdale.
Okay.
Probably in the neighborhood of like 1 ton or maybe less, but probably not less than, say, 1,000 pounds.
Right.
Big, compared to us, tiny compared to most other sauropods. Mm-hmm. If for the non-island dwarfs, like things that were on continental land masses, probably the smallest would be something like maybe Brachytrachelopan from South America, or Catadocus from the Morrison is a pretty small sauropod, probably in the neighborhood of small elephant size. Then they go up from there. Right now, the biggest one that we have solid evidence for is Argentinosaurus.
Yeah, that's an interesting animal. I think I stumbled upon Argentinosaurus along with Dreadnoughtus.
Yeah.
And so Dreadnoughtus versus Argentinosaurus.
Well, this is super interesting.
Okay.
Because these big sauropods don't exist in a scientific vacuum. There's also a lot of popular interest in them. And, of course, people care about big sauropods.
Mm-hmm.
And that can sometimes skew the narrative, especially in the way that it's reported in the popular press. So there's all this stuff, and I get loads of questions all the time about Dreadnoughtus. Was it actually bigger than Argentinosaurus? No. The biggest bones that we have from Dreadnoughtus are only 3/4 the size of the biggest bones we have from Argentinosaurus. It's a long way out.
Yeah.
Now, there is histological evidence that Dreadnoughtus was still growing. Maybe it would have gotten as big as Argentinosaurus, but to take an animal just because it's still growing and say it's going to get a third bigger than it is now,
yeah,
that's a pretty big stretch.
Yeah.
And for that matter, we don't have histological evidence that shows the Argentinosaurus was done growing.
God.
This is one of the great paradoxes about sauropods. Almost every big skeleton of a sauropod that people have seen in museums is from an animal that was not done growing.
Mm-hmm.
So the big Brachiosaurus that's mounted in Berlin, there are important joints in its body that would be fused in an adult that are not fused in that animal. And from the same beds in East Africa, there are fragmentary remains of animals more than 10% bigger. So,
jeez,
that's super cool to me, is that these big mounted skeletons in museums have been hugely important in shaping the public perception of dinosaurs and how big they got. And yet most of these things got even bigger than those skeletons indicate.
Which is, number one, mind-blowing.
Totally.
So when we're looking at these reconstructions or, you know, casts of these bones, so let's take Argentinosaurus, for example. How much of that skeleton has been discovered thus far?
Not very much. There are a couple of thigh bones, 2 or 3. There is a bone from the shin, the fibula, the same one that we've got in the side of our calf. Mm-hmm. There are about 8 vertebrae, I think, from the back, and maybe a couple from the tail and maybe a couple of ribs. There's not much. So this is one of the things about these big sauropods. Is as they get bigger, we find progressively less of them.
Right.
So even Brachiosaurus, like that mounted skeleton in Berlin, was cobbled together from 2 or 3 different individuals to make a complete skeleton, because there wasn't one complete skeleton. And then Sauroposeidon is bigger, and for that we only have 4 vertebrae. And I think that the way that this bell curve falls off, I think just has to do with physics, and the only way we find these fossils is if they get buried and preserved.
Yeah.
And at some point, when you're the size of a whale and you're on land,
just
wicked hard to bury the whole body in one go so it can all be preserved. So of course they're going to be rare.
So when the reconstructions of these animals, where we only have a few bones of, I assume it's much like the weird sort of history of Spinosaur. Because when they first discovered fragments of that, they were like, okay, this kind of looks like Suchomimus, and it kind of looks like Baryonyx, and they threw that together. But that wasn't really shown to be more or less false until that skeleton came out of that private collector's possession, and I think it was like 40% or more of it?
Something like that. I have that one not as well loaded in RAM. Or another good example would be Deinocheirus.
Okay.
Where we had the arms and it looked like a big Ornithomimosaur, and it is a big Ornithomimosaur, but then the body and the head look nothing like the other ostrich dinosaurs. It's this total weirdo with a big fat butt and a sail on its back, a weird wide face and a short neck. And basically, we got the most boring elements of the skeleton for decades, and we missed all the full tilt weirdness that it had going on every place else in its body. So, yes, there is always that specter that if we only have a part of an animal, then the missing part may be some full-tilt weirdo. But that, by and large, for these things, especially sauropods, where their body plan doesn't vary that much.
Mm-hmm.
Probably from relatives, we can fill it in. It'd be sort of like if there were no wolves, only coyotes, and you found a bone from a wolf, you'd be like, yeah, this probably looked like a bigger coyote. And you'd be approximately correct. Now, maybe they would have weird proportions. Maybe it'd be like a maned wolf or an African hunting dog or something like that. But more than likely, you'd be okay just sort of scaling up a coyote to wolf size and having a decent idea of what it was like.
So when you were going over the few vertebrae of Sauroposeidon, what did you hold that up against to say, okay, it's closest to X animal as opposed to Y?
Definitely it was Brachiosaurus and Giraffatitan. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Giraffatitan, the African one, hadn't really been split out. In fact, I think just a few minutes ago, I was referring to the one in Berlin as Brachiosaurus, and it's really Giraffatitan now. Sort of another Apatosaurus, Brontosaurus situation where the two animals were put together and then later on, in that case, shown to be way more different than Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus, because at least Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus are still each other's closest relatives, where now we know that there are loads of other Brachiosaurs that separate Brachiosaurus and Giraffatitan. When I was first looking at the bones, they had just sort of a gross similarity to the vertebrae of those two. And in fact, it took me a while to start picking out the differences. And part of that was just me on my very first research project trying to wrap my head around the incredible strangeness that is sauropod vertebrae.
Right.
Their limb bones are, you know, like cartoons. They're just like blobs that are slightly fatter at either end than they are in the middle. And their vertebrae are whacked out with all these strange processes and all these weird pockets and holes from the air sacs. And it actually takes a while just to wrap your head around, what am I even looking at here?
Now, something I always wondered, how did paleontologists decipher whether a sauropod like held its neck parallel to the ground or, you know, if it stretched up?
So, this is an interesting problem, and I've written about this with colleagues. There's a couple of things that are worth taking into account. One is, if we look at virtually all mammals, reptiles, birds, and amphibians, they hold their neck tilted up at the base where it joins the torso and then tilted down where it joins the head. That's their habitual pose.
Okay.
Even in salamanders that only have one vertebra in their neck, it's tilted up a little bit at the base and tilted down a little bit at the head. So their head's just a little bit higher than the rest of their body when they're just hanging out. Now, they may do something else with their head when they're moving. But this is sort of like their resting, alert posture.
Right.
As you go through reptiles, that posture gets higher. It's there in turtles. It's there in crocs. And when you get into mammals and birds, that posture often reaches vertical. So something like a cat or a bunny rabbit that's just sitting, hanging out, you can't really see what's going on with the vertebrae because, first of all, there's all that soft tissue on the neck, the muscles and the skin and everything. And then usually it's covered up by fur as well. But with x-rays, when x-rays are taken of these animals are just sitting there hanging out, usually their necks are straight vertical.
Really?
Yeah. The outside form of the neck is often a really bad guide to what the vertebrae are doing. I wrote a blog post about this called Necks Lie. Because if something like a horse, at the base of the neck where it joins the torso, the vertebrae are actually pretty far down in the neck. And there's this huge fat wedge of ligaments and tendons and muscles stacked on top. And then by the time you get up to the head, the vertebrae are joining the skull sort of near the top, and the bottom part of the neck is all fleshed out now with lots of like the larynx and the viscera and other separate muscles, so that whatever angle the external shape of the neck is, the vertebrae are actually tilted much more steeply upward. So you can't just look at an animal and say, oh, it's holding its neck at about 45 degrees, and say that's what the vertebrae are doing, because if the outside form of the neck is going at 45 degrees, the vertebrae may be at 60 or 70 or 80 degrees and headed almost straight up. So given that pretty much everything that has four legs that's alive today holds its neck tilted up, and the bigger you are and the faster the metabolism you have, the higher you hold your neck, it would make sense for sauropods to have done that too.
So sauropods, you know, back in the old days, I don't know if you want to call this an old wives' tale, but the working hypothesis was that these animals were so big that they had two brains, one in the head and one toward the back of their body, to sort of coordinate everything going on back there.
Oh, yeah, the butt brain hypothesis. That's my nemesis.
But as I was going through your book here, I noticed the sacral glycogen body.
Yeah.
So what is that, number one, and what is the evidence for it that you're finding?
So we all have holes that go through our vertebrae a big hole called the neural canal, and that's where our spinal cord runs. So your spinal cord runs in this protected bony tube that runs down the middle of your back. So pretty much all vertebrae have this hole on top to contain the spinal cord. When you get into the sacral region of sauropods and stegosaurs too, over the hips, that hole gets blown out to ridiculously large proportions. And something was filling it up, and it was probably something related to the spinal cord. Something that was the people who discovered this decades ago knew and talked about right away is that birds have this too. Loads of birds have this sacral expansion. And what's going on there in birds is it's part of the spinal cord that's grossly expanded, and it's storing glycogen, which is animal starch. We store it in our livers, and we mobilize it. We use it. So if you get hungry and there's no food around, if you have, you know, normal endocrine control, your liver will convert some of that glycogen into glucose and release it into your bloodstream. And now your cells are happy because they've got something to metabolize.
Okay.
We don't know what the glycogen's doing in birds, and we don't know why they'd have so much of it, and we don't know why they would store it over their butts.
Yeah.
All of those are still unknown questions. Why are they storing it in their spinal cord? That seems like a crazy thing to do when there's other options available. Lots of birds have fat pads underneath their skin over the hips anyway. So if you're storing energy underneath your skin, why do you also need to be storing it inside your spinal cord? And what are they doing with it? Are they actually mobilizing it? Or is it just sitting there in case they have a really bad week? Here's the thing. If we don't know what it's doing in birds that we can study, that there's tons of money from like agriculture to understand how they work, then we are completely hosed trying to figure out what it did in dinosaurs. The best we can say is probably, since it looks the same in these dinosaurs as it does in birds, it was doing whatever it does in birds. We've got to go solve this problem in birds first.
That's one of the millions of things that I have quoted to me constantly, completely incorrect, where they'll talk about the small brain in the ass of the dinosaur. Like, there's no possible way that's even remotely true.
No, we're all of us vertebrates run on a pretty standardized nervous system.
Right.
And what's true for one of us broadly is true for all of us. Do you know the story about how I was quote mined by a documentary about this butt brain theory?
No, but I want to hear it.
So, back in 2010 or 2012, the Discovery Channel had this series called Clash of the Dinosaurs. And I had done a ton of work for them with like the people who were, you know, doing fact finding and fact checking and things and trying to develop the narrative in advance of shooting. And I had a really good rapport with those folks. We went and did the shoot in Utah, and I had a fantastic time. And they were really, all the people who were on the shoot were tremendous, wonderful human beings. We laughed our butts off. We had a really good time. It was one of the most fun documentary shoots I've been on. And one of the producers on the show had just a hang up about this sacral brain theory, and he wanted me to address it. And so what I said was, well, we used to think, and then I laid out the by now thoroughly discredited butt brain theory.
Right.
And I said, but now we know, and I laid out the sacral glycogen body, which doesn't really have a very satisfying punchline, saying we don't know what it does in dinosaurs, but it probably did whatever it does in birds, and we also don't know that either. That's not a very good send-off.
No.
So when the show came on the air, what they had done is cut out the, here's what we used to think, and the, but now we know that, and just left me parroting this completely discredited idea as if it was current science.
That sucks.
And I was lit. I don't know if I've ever been so angry in my life. So I got on my blog and I said, look, y'all, this is what happened. And I'm writing to these folks. And by the way, here's the contact line for the Discovery Channel and for this production company. Please go harangue them and help me get this fixed. Full credit to everybody who went and went to bat for me, because like a day later, I got a call from a producer and he's like, all right, we're going to fix it. We won't re-air it and we won't put out a DVD until we have fixed that part.
Yeah, like if what is the Discovery Channel if not the place that the plebes go to for their information? And like,
oh dear. Well, this was about the time that the rot set in, and you know, it was all aliens and Bigfoot, and I honestly wonder how much of it had to do with the decline of the Full Tilt weirdo tabloid magazines. like, you know, the black and white one that, you know, that like alien gives birth to three-headed Elvis baby,
uh-huh.
that sort of stuff that was on the newsstands. It seems like right about the time that those really super crazy tabloid magazines died out is about the time that the Discovery Channel started its long downward slide from fairly reputable, decent, informative stuff to just utter hogwash.
Yeah, and that's I've been yelling about this for years, how like the Discovery Channel essentially turned into like a tabloid where we're talking about essentially aliens or Jesus or both. And doing a little research for this very show, I came across something. What now? So what are your opinion on these hidden sauropods that are living somewhere in either Africa or South America?
Oh man, when I was a kid, I was fascinated by cryptozoology. I remember when I was in third grade, I would check out these books on cryptozoology from the library.
Same here.
And during the day, I would just devour them. And then at night, I would lay awake, unable to sleep, worried that Bigfoot was going to come get me. So it was this weird love-hate. I was fascinated. I couldn't look away. I stared into the abyss, and I really thought the abyss was staring back.
Yeah.
And the idea that there was a living sauropod dinosaur in Africa, being a dinosaur nut as a kid, and having been only exposed to sort of this sensational side of cryptozoology and not to the rational, evidence-based debunkings of same.
Right.
The idea was incredibly tantalizing, and I wanted it to be true. Totally X-Files, I want to believe. I want to believe that there's a sauropod in Africa. And then, you know, I got older and learned about how folklore works and how tales grow in the telling. And also just... Man, one thing I'll say for these cryptids like Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and the sauropod in Africa, they do an awesome job of policing their dead bodies.
Oh, totally. Like,
yeah.
That's one of the most amazing things.
Every other thing gets hit on the highway, even in places where there's not very, maybe especially in places where there's not much in the way of highways. You know, there'll be a road going through the jungle and somebody will hit a water buffalo or something. It happens all the time.
Right.
But these guys, the one thing all these guys share is if they do ever get hit, they must have like some kind of freaking CSI team that comes in and cleans that shit up so nobody ever sees it.
Well, yeah, not only that, and I don't want to go too far down the cryptozoology rabbit hole, but I could all day. But so my problem with all of these theories is these animals are usually purported to be very large, like the sauropod, Nessie, who's possibly a plesiosaur or whatever you want to call it. And even to a lesser extent, Bigfoot. These are huge animals that would require an enormous intake of food.
Yeah, yeah.
And to sustain themselves, there need to be more than one. I'm guessing. I'm no scientist.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to have a viable population base. And it's amazing to me that as humans have spread out and colonized the globe and we've fenced off the wilderness into smaller and smaller packages, you know, surely these cryptids must have experienced massive die-offs.
Right.
The same way that bison and everybody else did, and yet they policed all the bodies out of the way. I'm in awe of their forensic abilities. And if I ever do accidentally murder someone, I'm going to call freaking Bigfoot in to help me hide the body because
yeah, who
evidently
else?
They're amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got him and Nessie on speed dial.
Excellent, excellent, yeah.
So here's a touchy issue for me, simply because I don't want it to be true. So going over your book, I read that you're kind of going away from the gastrolith concept.
Yeah, well, so the idea that sauropods were swallowing rocks specifically to help mash up the plant food because they were no longer chewing is tantalizing. We know that some sauropods did swallow stones. We know they've been found in the rib cages of these things. And even there, just because you find a pile of rocks inside the rib cage of a dead animal does not mean that it swallowed those rocks.
Right.
Sometimes those rocks could have drifted in during the process of decomposition and burial. But even in the best documented cases, there is just not enough rocks. It's a little tiny pile of rocks. Hmm. And in birds that use rocks as an actual gastric mill to help grind their food, it's a lot of rocks. And we know that there were dinosaurs that did do this. Caudipteryx, this little oviraptorosaur with feathers from China. Some of those specimens have a big pile of pebbles, like dozens and dozens of pebbles
right.
in the stomach area that all show wear that's consistent with being a gastrolith.
I remember seeing that.
Yeah. The sauropod examples, they just don't have enough rocks. So it wasn't enough. It would be like a human swallowing like, I don't know, four little pebbles and expecting that to grind up all our food. It's just not right. enough.
So is the prevailing theory then when they find these stones that have been worked smooth in the rib cages and scattered around these sauropods? Are they just accidentally ingested and don't move through the system, or is it just this must have blown in after the fact?
It depends on the where. Some of them probably were washed in accidentally. Some of them are probably legitimately things that the animals were eating. And I don't think it was necessarily accidental. Loads of animals eat stones and eat dirt to get the minerals.
Huh.
And a lot of people don't know that. One great example that I absolutely adore is hummingbirds. If there's a fire, like a forest fire, or in town, if there's like a house fire, a lot of times as soon as the ashes are cool, there will be a hummingbird come and land and start licking at the ashes, because basically when you burn wood, you're boiling out all the crap they don't need and sort of concentrating like the rare earth elements and all the weird stuff that they do need, and they can lick up the ashes and get their little dose. Because, you don't get a lot of your rare earth metals and minerals from eating nectar.
Yeah, I'd imagine not.
Yeah, and then it scales all the way up. Giraffes are famous for doing this. Desert tortoises will... you put radio trackers on desert tortoises, they'll sort of hang out in their sort of normal territory most of the time. And then occasionally they'll just head out like a laser straight line and go on this long ass hike, hundreds of yards, to a particular place, like in a stream bed, where a certain layer of earth has been exposed. And they'll dig in there and munch on that stuff and get their minerals and then go straight back to their hole.
Yeah, I guess that's good. Somewhat to hear, because when I read that in the book, I immediately wanted to go to my display of fossils and pull out the gastroliths and curse the men who sold them to me, because one even went so far as to label it as it was found within the rib cage of an Alamosaurus.
Huh.
So
that seems unlikely. I think that one might have made it into a museum. Or
I would have thought so too. But every rock and mineral show out there, And I've canvassed all of them all over Arizona, they always sell fossils, either dinosaur or something from the Miocene era or whatever. But you can always, always, always find gastroliths, even at people's booths that don't sell dinosaur-related things. So I sort of started getting skeptical about it.
Yeah. There have been some interesting papers coming out of sedimentary geology showing that, because one of the arguments for gastroliths is, all right, we're standing in a bed of mudstone that was laid down in, like a quiet river setting. And here's this perfectly, smoothed stone that could not have been moved by water as gentle as what laid down this deposit. So somebody had to bring it here, and probably a sauropod brought it here and barfed it up. That's a nice, neat story. But now what we're finding out is that when a river is in flood stage, rocks up to the fist size can absolutely be picked up and transported in the water column and even thrown from the surface of the water where there's a big ripple or something.
Wow.
So there is absolutely a way to move rocks and to smooth them into areas, and then when the flood dies down, these rocks fall out in a big sea of mud and boom, there's your scenario. You've got mudstone, you've got a nice smooth rock. It didn't require a sauropod to barf it up. It just required wacky hydrodynamics.
Man, that was a real bummer for yours truly.
Yeah, for me too. And my first glimpse that something was up with that hypothesis was when I was out in the field in Montana with the Oklahoma Museum crew in the summer of 98. Because every place that we went in the Cloverleaf Formation, we'd find just crap loads of these smooth stones, the gastroliths, in the shale or the mudstone or whatever. We'd always take them back to camp and set them on a table. And by the time we'd been there for a week, the surface of this table was covered with gastroliths. And we're starting to be like, wait a second. Can all of these things be gastroliths? It seems a little unlikely.
Yeah.
So some of them probably were. Many of them probably were not. And as far as being able to make that call for any particular one, I don't know enough about it. If it was found within a rib cage, your chances are obviously a lot better.
Right.
Even then, it's still not bulletproof. So,
still, if you can say that you own something that a sauropod swallowed, I'll still count that up as a W.
Hey.
And I'm even willing to believe that the things I have aren't completely fake, too. So,
totally. Hey, if it passed through a sauropod digestive tract, that's still cool.
Yeah, that's still a plus. So, now, this is something I brought up at the Beer and Bones, but... the sauropod population in North America post-Jurassic is essentially zero compared to what it had been previously.
It's super, super weird. Because when you go to the Jurassic, and the Morrison Formation, sauropods are the most abundant elements in the fauna. There's more right. sauropods than there are stegosaurs. There's more sauropods than there are camptosaurs. Wherever you go in the Morrison, you find sauropods first. And then maybe, if you're lucky, you find some other things. So it's super weird in that the biggest things in the fauna are also the most abundant. That's not usually how ecosystems work.
Right.
When we go to the early Cretaceous, sauropods are still around, but now they're almost always the rarest elements in the fauna. So, for example, southeast Oklahoma, where we found Sauroposeidon, I would guess that the Oklahoma Museum probably pulled out on the order of 24 different individuals of Tenontosaurus in various stages of completeness over the years, as well as Deinonychus. And I think there are two Acrocanthosaurus specimens that made up the holotype and the paratype back in the 50s. And then there was the really nice one that's now in North Carolina. So we've got, even for Acrocanthosaurus, we've got three good ones from Oklahoma and a fourth good one from Texas. And for Sauroposeidon, we have one from Oklahoma.
I'm so interested. Like, so what are there any theories as to why that happened? Like the pairing off of these giant animals?
It does look pretty solid now that most sauropods prefer drier inland environments, and that if conditions got too wet, they weren't big on that. Now, there were some sauropod groups that we do find in coastal environments or even on islands and intra-oceanic platforms of land, which I guess is just a really poncy way of saying an island.
Yeah.
So there were some of them, and probably all of them would put up with it if pushed to it. I mean, try to think of an environment that an elephant absolutely refuses to go into. They go anywhere. They go to the desert, they go to the tundra, they go out to the ocean. But that's right. Not where they prefer to hang out. They definitely prefer to hang out in like a mixed woodland savanna.
Now, I may be getting the facts wrong, but it's during the Cretaceous that there was that huge inland sea in what is now North America. Is that right?
In the late Cretaceous is when that inland sea actually connects all the way from the Gulf of Mexico and the Hudson Bay sort of meet and totally cleave the continent in two. But there had been other iterations of that sea, even in the Jurassic, like the Sundance Sea. So basically the northern part of that seaway had come down into Wyoming and even into Utah time and again. It advanced, it had retreated, and only in the late Cretaceous do things happen such that it connects with the Gulf of Mexico and totally cuts the continent in half.
Hmm.
So why are we finding fewer sauropods in the Cretaceous? Is it that the deposits that we have are from environments that sauropods just didn't prefer? And maybe the sauropods are still there, but they're just living someplace else? Is it an actual biological thing that we just don't understand the reasons for? Whatever it is, there's been tendency to look at this weird pattern that we have in North America and assume that that's what was going on worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly for sauropods, that's absolutely not the case, because this decline of sauropods in the Cretaceous just doesn't happen in South America. It doesn't happen in Asia. As far as we can tell, the only place it happens is in North America. So in North America, we also have in the late Cretaceous these huge herds of duck-billed dinosaurs and horned dinosaurs and a vast diversity of these things that you don't get other places. You've got a few duckbills in Asia, very few of the derived horned dinosaurs, if any. What you do still have in Asia in the Cretaceous is lots of sauropods. It may be that we get this blossoming of horned and duckbilled dinosaurs in North America because we could, because the sauropods were sort of cleared out of the way and there was ecological space for those things to fill.
Yeah, that is an interesting concept, because I had come upon that same thought only in reverse. I thought that perhaps the rise of these ceratopsians and hadrosaurs and stuff were essentially eating everybody out of house and home and sort of forced the bigger dinosaurs out of the territory.
I think it must be the other way, if the two are related at all. And the reason I say that is that there was a gap in North America when there's just not sauropods. So the last of the old guard, the things that are probably holdovers from the Jurassic, go extinct around 100 million years ago, or 98 million years ago, right around then. And then Alamosaurus comes in the late Cretaceous, probably came either up from South America or over from Asia, but it's all by itself, at least for now. We don't know of any others. It's not super common, and it's after a 10 or 15 million year gap where there were no sauropods. And during those 10 or 15 million years, ceratopsians and hadrosaurs were starting to go bonkers. So
yeah,
when by the time Alamosaurus got here, there's already this evolutionary radiation of hadrosaurs and horned dinosaurs going on.
That's interesting, and I'm curious to see if there's any headway made in that, especially now that things are coming, you know, down the pipe on a daily basis. I can't wait to see if there's something to indicate what happened with them.
Yeah, I would love to know myself, because they were a pretty successful body plan. Actually, to me, that's one of the strangest things about sauropods, is that they're super successful. From the late Triassic onwards, they're globally distributed, and except for this weird thing that happens in North America in the Cretaceous, they're usually either the most abundant, or at least among the most abundant things in the fauna, and yet they really only do one thing.
Right.
You look at all these other dinosaur groups, and they're evolving in all these different directions, and they're not staying put. But I could take the first sauropod that ever existed and the last sauropod that ever existed, and if you stood back about 100 yards and squinted, you'd have a hard time telling them apart. There's lots of changes under the hood, little things with what they're doing with their air sacs and their teeth and the way their muscles and their limb girdles are working. But outside, it's still just basically a fat body on four legs with a long neck and a long tail, and that's all they ever do.
Yeah, there was just something about that long neck that spelled success for these things.
Yes, spelled success, but also locked them into not doing anything else. The term that comes to mind is evolutionary ratchet. I think it was Blair Van Valkenburg. She's a paleontologist here in California. She works on lots of things, primarily mammals, and especially carnivores. I think she's the one, it was either her or Christine Janis, who proposed that hypercarnivores, so carnivores that only eat things that they kill, like you know, the dog family and the cat family, that was an evolutionary ratchet for mammals. That if, as long as you're an omnivore, like a raccoon or a bear, you can evolve in lots of different directions. If you're a bear, you can still evolve into being pretty much a pure herbivore like a panda. But once you become a hypercarnivore, you're stuck. That's all that you do for the rest of your evolutionary history. Now, you may be successful, you may be diverse. It doesn't mean you're going to go extinct. What it means is, that's your job from now until the end of time.
Right.
And I think that maybe the sauropod body plan was an evolutionary ratchet in that sense, that it was obviously successful, but once they started doing that, they never did anything else. And for crying out loud, they had 160 million years to try.
Yeah.
160 million years of variation away from that body plan that got smacked down every single time by natural selection. That's a pretty isolated adaptive peak that they're stuck on.
We've seen that in quite a few things, like arthropods. Like the lobster hasn't really made a lot of changes since, you know, it was a thing. Like turtles.
Exactly. There are certain body plans that are just really good. Alligators.
Yeah.
Alligators and crocodilians externally have not changed much at all since the middle Jurassic. Now, that's not a great example, though, because the ones that we have left now haven't done anything else. But there were ocean-going crocodiles, both during the Age of Dinosaurs and afterwards. There were land-living crocodiles with long legs that were fast runners. So crocs definitely did other stuff. Those other avenues weren't closed to them. It's just that at the same time, there were always crocs in the water looking pretty much like modern crocs, doing what modern crocs do. But sauropods seem to have been even more limited than that. They weren't even as diverse ecologically as crocs. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's like, so what we're looking at here is they stumbled upon these series of traits that they just kept cultivating through breeding.
Yeah.
And I guess if you find something that works and you're not necessarily beholden to any super fast environmental changes or anything like that, I can see a species landing on something and sticking with it, much like, you know, I've got a tortoise in the backyard that looks exactly like some of the fossils I see at the museum today.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is that it's a sword that cuts both ways. So the sauropod body plan was super successful, but it's surrounded by a moat of possibilities that just weren't viable anymore. Mm-hmm. Whatever path prosauropods took evolving into sauropods, sauropods apparently couldn't go back down that path and turn into anything else. They were stuck. They were isolated. It's just the nature of development to produce variation. So variation's always being produced, but then a lot of times it's getting pruned away by natural selection. And for the entire evolutionary history of sauropods, after the start of the Jurassic, anything that didn't look like a sauropod didn't make it. They couldn't move away and do anything else. And that's pretty interesting because we don't see a lot of that, I feel like.
In a lot of the documentaries that you see, whether they highlight a specific sauropod or like, let's say Spinosaurus, for example, because that's like a hot ticket that even non-dinosaur people are like really starting to get into. A lot of the theories that I'm hearing regarding that is it developed these bizarre, the fin and the long mouth and the conical teeth. And they were just essentially a product of like becoming super good at one thing. But when that one thing was no longer available, like, sorry, that's it. Like you put all your eggs in this basket and that basket doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's something in the US where maybe the food changed or something happened,
right,
that all of these millions of years and these traits were now rendered null and void.
That's interesting. So one thing that you obviously need if you're a sauropod is you're absolutely locked in to getting, we know that they grew fast.
Right.
And presumably have fast metabolisms. You know, most of their physiology shouts, I'm like a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And birds are high energy animals. So they're locked in to getting buttloads of plants constantly. And if there is some sort of crisis, like a regional crisis, where suddenly there's not buttloads of plants, then it's going to hit the sauropods hard. And it's not only going to hit them hard, it's going to hit them harder than anybody else because they need more than anybody else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe there's some regional event in North America. The thing is, it wouldn't have to be very long. I mean, for crying out loud, even if it's like some short, sharp thing that we just haven't picked up in the fossil record, something that would wipe out all the plants and keep them wiped out for a decade even would be enough to do the job. And then there's no sauropods and there's not going to be any more until some of them move in from someplace else.
Like realistically, if you're a ceratopsian and you weigh 4 to 6 tons, you're going to need to eat a lot less than something that's 30, 40 tons. So
yeah.
Even if you're a big land animal for, you know, today's standards,
right,
you could probably still scrape by. But if you need to eat tons and tons and tons of vegetation and that's just not available.
Right. Sauropods are so far out there. They're so much bigger than everybody else that their requirements are consequently, you know, like they're not really playing the same sport.
Right.
All the other dinosaurs are sort of like next to each other on the spectrum of how much energy you need to put through yourself. And then, you know, sauropods are way out there. They're a long step away from everybody else, at least the very biggest ones. It is interesting that sauropods were able to evolve into island dwarfs.
Yeah.
On these islands. It's also interesting that they didn't get super small. They didn't get as small as the smallest elephants do on islands. And that they still looked pretty much like just smaller versions of their mainland counterparts. One kind of, on the surface, maybe loony idea that's sort of been growing in my mind is, I wonder if sauropods are all one group. Like, did they all evolve from just a single ancestor and then they're the group that we think that they are? Or is this a situation like placental wolves and marsupial wolves, where you can have different origins and end up looking superficially very similar, even though you have a very different evolutionary history?
That is interesting. And I always thought, I've moral of the story is I've shared that same thought, because you think, you know, all of these similar traits are all over the world. And if they're stemming off of one semi-long-necked dinosaur that has like quasi-hands that eventually blow up to this world-dominating thing.
Well, so when we got molecular evolutionary trees for mammals that were based on DNA and then later on whole genomes,
mm-hmm,
we realized that most of what we thought about mammal evolution based on the morphology of the bones was hogwash, that there were huge rearrangements, that there's this group called Afrotheria that, you know, part of this we knew. We knew that elephants and manatees and hyraxes were related to each other. People didn't know that aardvarks were in there too, and golden moles, for crying out loud. So you've got this little mole that's the size of your hand that's digging around in the dirt that's more closely related to an elephant and to a manatee than it is to the mole that's in your backyard. That's crazy. So where we see these really specific sets of adaptations that lock you into a particular way of life, like being a mole,
mm-hmm,
we see that body form evolve over and over again from different groups. So if it can happen for the mole body form, like at least three times, if not four, just among modern mammals, let alone the mole form things that have gone extinct in the past, why couldn't it have happened for sauropods?
You know, when I was young and I was learning about how animals were sort of grouped together based on essentially nothing more than their appearance and their bone structure, even back then I was like, is that right? Because what if, and the advent of DNA really, I don't want to say vindicated my thoughts. It was interesting to see that DNA really cuts through a lot of the crap and shows you exactly what we're looking at instead of being like, this shin bone sort of looks like that one, and so these two animals are related.
Right, exactly. What you want to trace evolution is something that evolves in a clock-like fashion that's not super influenced by the environment. Because if you're using traits that are strongly influenced by the environment, then whenever you have parallel or convergent evolution to the same body form, then you're going to get your signal's going to get polluted with that environmentally influenced noise. Right. You're going to get situations like wolves and marsupial wolves that superficially look identical, even though they came from different backgrounds. Now, in that case, there were things that we knew enough about marsupials that even if we, you know, little tricks about counting teeth and looking at specific features of the skull, we could assess that one out. But that's because we have these things still around.
Right.
Or at least did until very recently for marsupial wolves. For sauropods, we're looking at all this evidence that's been left out in the rain for 100 million years. Mm-hmm. If, you know, we're missing one or two of those crucial links where something tumbled down an adaptive slope really quickly and sort of landed on the sauropod body form and then took off and was successful, by the time it shows up someplace else, you know, it looks like a sauropod. It walks, it quacks. We see it and we're like, oh, hey, it's just another weird sauropod. Weird in the sense that it's got, you know, stuff going on under the hood, even though outside it's still your bog standard snake run through a turtle or whatever.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I can't prove that. And in fact, the evidence right now that we have right now is very much against it. But my suspicion is that in a few more decades, we're going to get good enough at pulling proteins out of dinosaur bones. We're going to find some protein that evolved in enough of a clock-like manner that we can start doing molecular evolutionary trees for dinosaurs. And I predict that when that happens, it's going to shake things up for dinosaurs just as much as it did for mammals. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't have. Look at all the times that lizards have lost their legs and evolved into a snake-like shape. Right. They do that at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I realize that's a different case than something evolving to look like a sauropod, but, you know, if you're a sauropod, you've got a simplified skull, you're getting rid of a lot of your teeth, your limb bones are achieving these simplified shapes. Matt Bonin had a great talk about this at SVP maybe 15 years ago or farther back about how sauropod limb bones are just basically cartoons. So a lot of the specialized anatomy that you use to track evolutionary change is kind of getting tossed out the window. And so they all end up looking like each other. Now, is that evidence of shared ancestry, or is that evidence that they actually have achieved the same body shape that fits a particular ecological role,
yeah,
even though they came from different ancestors? To me, it's a tantalizing possibility. I don't know that it's correct, but I think for sauropods in particular, they seem like if there's any dinosaur group that's going to turn out to have had multiple evolutionary origins, because the sauropod body plan is so constrained, I think they're one of the best bets.
Yeah, I'm picking up what you're putting down, because if you're one of these lower life forms, like essentially, you know, running around between sauropod feet, they're looking at that and being like, wow, that is something that works, and picking out those traits in their own species.
Yeah, natural selection, if it pushes them in that direction. Now, it's not necessarily easy to pick out who would be your contenders to feed right into that, but then there's still a lot of the fossil record that we don't have yet, and we're still finding surprising things. I mean, there's whole branches of the evolutionary tree of dinosaurs that we've only discovered in the past 5 or 10 years. We've only figured out what they looked like in the past decade or two. So certainly we shouldn't get too comfortable with the idea that we know what the shape of dinosaur diversity is like. There's still plenty of weird stuff out there to be found.
Every time I learn something that changes, like, a fact that I held in my brain about any sort of dinosaur, I think, oh, cool, we're getting a picture closer to the truth. Like, that is genuinely exciting, whereas before I feel like people were like, You know, dinosaurs were in swamps and that's that. We'll just leave it there.
No, they were doing so much weird stuff. And now that we're starting to learn about all the weird stuff that they were doing, it's tremendously exciting.
My next question is egg-laying strategy for sauropods. In my tertiary glances, what I'm seeing is that the bigger they are, the less likely they are to hang out with the kids, essentially.
Yeah, and we have an interesting thing about where animals that lay their eggs together, how those nests are spaced out. Mm-hmm. If you look at something like a breeding colony of seabirds, all of the nests are going to be about the same distance apart from one another. And furthermore, the distance between those nests is probably going to be about a length of one adult animal. On the other hand, if you have animals that just dump their eggs and then wander off and do no parental care whatsoever, like sea turtles, the nests are going to be completely random. Some of them will be way far apart. Some will be almost on top of each other. We have sauropod nesting grounds from Argentina. They look nothing like the seabird model. They look exactly like the sea turtle model, where it looks like these guys were just coming in, scratching out a little nest. We know that they buried their eggs, that they were digging out nests, probably with their hind feet.
Okay.
And dropping a few eggs and then burying them. We know that from several lines of evidence. Sometimes we actually find the eggs in a nest that's clearly been dug out. We know from the porosity of the eggshell, determined under a microscope, that it's more consistent with eggs that are buried than with eggs that are left on the surface. Mm-hmm. Because people don't always think about this, but eggs have to breathe.
Right.
There's an organism in there that has to take in oxygen and get rid of carbon dioxide. But what eggs also have to do is not lose too much water in the process. So if you're on the surface and you have great big pores, then you're going to lose a lot of water, and through evaporation, you're going to dry out. If you're underground and you're in moist soil, you probably need a bigger pore to get enough gas in and out to keep you alive. And you can afford to do that without drying out because the soil is moist. You're not going to be evaporating that much. So sauropod eggs, both where we find the nests and the fine structure of the eggshell, tells us that they were buried. What's super interesting to me is we never find that many eggs in one hole. Like most sauropod nests are in the neighborhood of a dozen eggs. There's one or two that have been found that go up to the neighborhood of maybe 20. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of the scale, we've got some that only have two or three. So there's no way that even 20 eggs is the complete reproductive output of a female sauropod for a year. That's ridiculous. Right. If it's true, then sauropods were putting way less into reproduction than we think.
No kidding.
And way less than any other animal actually does. So probably they're making lots and lots of nests. If you have eggs that are underground and they have to breathe, you don't want to put too many in a single hole because they'll suffocate each other. Mm-hmm. And then when one of them goes bad and rots, then the whole batch is lost. Also, probably putting lots of eggs in lots of holes was literally not putting all your eggs in one basket to dodge predators. And there are plenty of animals that do that today. Lots of turtles will either lay multiple nests, or they'll lay one main nest, and then they'll dig a little hole off to the side and put one or two eggs over there. It's kind of like a little insurance policy.
Right.
And nest predation is a huge problem for things like turtles. Snapping turtles are a great example. In most snapping turtle populations, the annual recruitment, so the number of babies that survive to join the population, is zero. Because 100% of the nests get found and destroyed by predators. But, you know, snapping turtles are laying like 30 or 50 eggs at a time. So if just one nest survives, then the babies hatch out and they're snapping turtles. They're mean as hell right out of the gate.
Right.
And you're good. You know, you only need maybe one nest in a population to survive every 5 or 10 years, and you can still keep a viable population going. So I imagine, you know, we've all seen the documentaries, the baby sea turtles hatching out, just pouring out of the beach. And like the foxes and the seagulls have come and they're eating baby turtles until they're just stuffed. Right. And, you know, the last baby sea turtle is crawling into the surf past this seagull that's eaten so many that he's just like, screw it, dude. I can't even be bothered to chase you. I imagine that the hatching day for sauropods was the same. You know, that you've got these little rabbit-sized baby sauropods just boiling out of the ground. And the allosaurs and things, at first they're just running around, cramming them into their faces as fast as they can. And after a couple hours, there's this allosaur laying there with this giant distended stomach, watching the last little sauropods run into the underbrush. And he's just like, screw it, I can't be bothered. You get away.
So in your research, have you come across any sauropods that have that sort of maternal care toward their young, or is it all just like set it and forget it?
Zero evidence of maternal care in sauropods. And in fact, which is pretty darned interesting because there's actually more evidence of maternal care in prosauropods than there is in sauropods. So maternal care seems to have been something that sauropods actually got rid of. They lost it in evolutionary terms and went back to set it and forget it.
That's so interesting because, like, you'd think that the most, you know, like the Camarasaur was the most proliferous animal of the Jurassic in North America. And they're just like, oh, yeah, I'll drop some eggs here and some eggs there. Who cares? Whatever. Stuff will happen. Meanwhile, you've got, like, theropods who you would think, oh, you know, they're not going to hang out. I mean, they're doing parental care, as most of the studies I've seen have shown.
Yeah. Well, we have evidence pretty much every group of dinosaurs other than sauropods was doing parental care.
Like when Horner found that Egg Mountain with all the Mayasaurs, like that was mind-blowing. Everyone was like, they take care of their young. And now, like, it's pretty much everybody's doing it, save the sauropods. But they're still, like, wildly successful. So it's a strategy that works, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a classic quality versus quantity thing. If you are going to invest in your offspring, then you can't afford to make very many of them.
Right.
And then the fewer of them you make, the more you're sort of forced to invest in them until you get to a situation like with whales and elephants and us, where you're usually only having one baby at a time, and then you're putting just insane resources into it for years. And then the complete opposite end of the scale is a sea turtle, where in a season, a female will crap out like 300 eggs and never see them again. But every bit of energy that she saves on bringing food to the babies or nursing them or defending them from predators, that's all energy that she can plow into making more eggs next year. Because let's say in a given year that 100% of the nests are found and destroyed or 100% of the hatchlings get eaten by predators. As long as a few of them get through, once you get to a sufficient size, you're pretty much predator bulletproof. Yeah. And then you can just start spamming the environment with dozens or hundreds of eggs every year. And who's going to stop you? If most of them get found and eaten, who cares? You'll make more.
Yeah, they're just the original grind engines. They're just these locomotives on feet that are just running plant material through them and popping out replicants.
Exactly, exactly. A sauropod is a machine for converting pine needles into baby sauropods.
It makes a lot of sense when you step back and think of it, because sauropods, their brains aren't the most complex of their ilk. So when you're looking at something like a theropod, like let's say an Allosaurus, and they're having way less than the sauropods are having, but they're pumping out these eggs, they have to teach them hunting, they have to teach them, whereas like herbivores, like the world is your
oyster.
There's
a plant. There's a plant. Go eat it.
Yeah, like if a mother allosaur doesn't teach their kids how to hunt, chances are they're not going to make it.
Interesting. I wonder how much we know about their that would be it's too bad you're not interviewing Dave Hone, because he has his finger on the pulse of the dinosaur predator stuff, and he would know if their hunting tactics were sophisticated enough that they would need to be taught, or if instinct would lead the way. But certainly there's plenty of evidence that theropod dinosaurs were taking care of their offspring. And frankly, for any of these dinosaurs, that shouldn't have been surprising, because we've known forever that dinosaurs are bracketed by crocs and birds. It's just that most people don't know how much parental care crocs actually do in terms of looking after their babies, you know, hanging out and guarding the nest and looking after their babies afterwards. When we found out that dinosaurs were doing that, it should have been like, oh, null hypothesis confirmed. And instead, everybody's freaking out because our mental model of dinosaurs was what sauropods are actually doing, which is, as you said, set it and forget it.
Right. Well, I mean, just from a non-scientific, like a layperson's point of view, if you're looking at an animal that has to just eat, and that's all it does to stay alive and reproduce, and food is abundant, there's not a lot of instruction. But if you're a theropod running around, you have to know what animals are a go and don't. And,
right.
And
where don't mess with Stegosaurus unless you're really hungry.
Right.
Try to find a baby sauropod, because until they get big enough for size to be a deterrent, they're pretty much just meat on the hoof.
Yeah. And with, you know, it's hard to speculate on the visual acuity and the sense of smell of these animals. But I imagine that would be something you could pass down to your offspring. Like, you could be like, okay, here's a sauropod nest. Get a good sniff. Like, this is a meal ticket.
Yeah, totally. Or here, let's go into the woods and I'll find you, you know, a horse-sized sauropod that has absolutely nothing going for it because it's not big enough to be a threat, but it's also not fast.
Yeah.
So let me run it down and tear it apart, and you can watch how easy it is to get these guys. And now you know all you got to do is run around in the woods and look for these walking hamburgers and you're set.
Exactly. So there's definitely at least tangential evidence to be like, there's a skill set that needs to be taught to these certain animals. Whereas others are just like, you know, whatever, you'll figure it out. Trust me.
Yeah, I could buy that. One of the things that's really interesting to me about sauropod herding behavior is we know that they did form herds from these mega track sites, but we don't find baby sauropod footprints in there.
Yeah.
The smallest ones in the mega track sites are usually like at least a third the size of the largest, which means there's the whole first third of their development is happening not with the herd. It's happening probably off by themselves in the woods trying to hide, and then they get big enough that they can finally keep up, and not coincidentally, they may be becoming sexually mature at the same time.
Right, so they'd be forced out to...
Maybe, because we know now that most dinosaurs were becoming sexually mature way before they were full grown, which for us mammals is kind of a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of screws with our whole idea of what an adult dinosaur is. Andy Farkey and Dave Hone and I wrote a paper about this last year. If you're a mammal or a bird, then getting to full body size and having the joints in your skeleton close up and having sexual maturity come in, they don't all happen at exactly the same time, but they happen pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Close enough in time that it's not ambiguous what an adult is versus a non-adult.
Right.
And with dinosaurs, usually those things don't happen together at all. Usually they're becoming sexually mature way early, like maybe a third of full size, and then they can be very big and what we would think of as functionally an adult and still not have their bones fused up, but they've still achieved basically like an adult anatomy.
That is so crazy.
Their bones all have the adult form. They just haven't fused up yet. And so it raises this really interesting possibility, which is once you can reproduce as juveniles, do you even need adults? I can imagine that times when resources were lean, you might have a sauropod herd where there just are no grown-ups because there's not enough resources to sustain them. The juveniles come up, they become sexually mature, they get a couple of clutches of eggs in the ground, and then either they starve or get eaten by predators, and the new generation comes up and it's more juveniles reproducing.
Right.
And maybe you only get, maybe one of the reasons these big sauropods are so rare, not only is it that they're hard to bury, but that they just don't come along that often. Maybe once in 1,000 years, you have the right combination of several good growing seasons and a local decrease in the number of predators and whatever other factors they needed that would allow one of these things to sort of make it through the gauntlet and become one of these supermassive, essentially unassailable egg factories.
Okay, so that raises an interesting question in my mind. So there is evidence to support the fact that theropods had like super immune systems. They could essentially take a lot of damage and not succumb to either infection or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Is there evidence in that, or rather evidence for that in sauropods?
Almost none. There is evidence of things like vertebral fusion, probably in a lot of cases from arthritis. But the kinds of stuff that you get in theropods with loads of broken bones and like seeping wounds and all this stuff, we just don't see it in sauropods. And it's not that nobody's looking or that we don't know what to look for. It's that it's not there. Because this has been on my mind for a decade at least, is why do we see all this damage in these theropods and we're not seeing it in sauropods? And I think it's because if you're a theropod, an encounter that's likely to damage you is something that happens every day. It's how you get your meal.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a sauropod, either you're so big that you're pretty much immune to that, or if you're not, if you're capable of being attacked, you're probably only going to go through one of those events in your life, and it's going to end up with you being turned into theropod poop.
Right.
And they're not surviving many, many combats. Actually, this, I would love to know. Darren Nash would be the person to ask, who blogs at Tetrapod Zoology, because he knows a lot of this stuff about extant animals, is I wonder if people who work on, say, big mammals see that. Like, are you more likely to see a lion has lots of healed injuries than you are to see a wildebeest.
Yeah, because I know definitely the research pertaining to dinosaurs like this has been mirrored pretty much in crocodilians, and they're finding that they can lose limbs, lose eyes, lose, like, you know, take massive battle damage.
Oh, yeah.
And even though they're living in water that's 90% their own shit, they're, you know, totally cool.
Yeah, turtles come to mind. So I'm kind of a nut about turtles. I've had pet turtles since the time I was a little tiny kid. If there were no dinosaurs, I'd definitely be working on turtles.
Right.
But when I was a kid, all the time, you know, we'd catch turtles that had been injured on the highway and were, like, missing a limb or more than one limb. People have found snapping turtles with the most appalling wounds, like missing two or three limbs, or with their lower jaw missing, or with a throat full of fish hooks, and they just keep on trucking. So, yeah, there's decent evidence that theropods, a lot of theropods, were built the same way. But think about, like, I'm thinking about lions and wildebeests now. Mm-hmm. If you're a wildebeest, how often in your life are you going to feel the claws of a lion?
Once.
Probably
I
once.
Bet. Yeah.
But if you're a lion, how often are you going to sink your claws into a wildebeest?
And get kicked or gored, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. On a weekly basis, if not more often. So these antagonistic encounters, these combats between predator and prey, for the predators, that's daily business. For the prey, it's hopefully never. For almost all of them, it will come around eventually.
Right.
But it's probably only going to come around once.
And
so
that could be a perfect, you know, something to slot into that query where, like, if you've got these giant dinosaurs, even though their size is there, and the injury doesn't even have to come from a predatory dinosaur. If they fall, something falls on them, or, you know, they could get an abscess in their tooth. And even though, you know, even if it's constantly resupplying its mouth with teeth, if something gets stuck, I mean, any amount of infection could just take them down, I'm sure, because they don't have these robust immune systems that the theropods need by virtue of their existing.
Huh, that's a pretty interesting idea. Yeah, I also wonder about things like population density. Mm-hmm. And for these big guys that are moving around a lot, they're probably coming into contact with animals from farther afield. They'll probably have more opportunities to swap their germs around as well.
Right. Yeah, so there's tons of stuff there I would love to find out eventually. Okay, so sauropods, even though pretty much the same body type every one you look at, some of them did have some pretty interesting traits, like the spike tail of the Shunosaurus, the big chambered head of the Camarasaurus, or even the frills of the Amargosaurus.
Yeah, totally.
What are some of the most interesting permutations of sauropod physiology that most speak to you?
The face of Nigerosaurus, where literally looks like a letter T, where the jaws are expanded and the tooth row is completely flat across the front. And it really, really looks like it's adapted for, you know, it's definitely doing something on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's been proposed that it was a grazer and that it was, you know, cropping plants very low to the ground. And maybe it was. I actually got to see the jawbones of Nigerosaurus in person when I was in Chicago back in 2000, courtesy of Paul Serino. Mm-hmm. And the holes in the jaw for the teeth, it looked to me like there was space between them. That instead of the teeth just being side by side by side to make a big, essentially, blade across the front of the mouth, it would have looked more like a comb. And that's still not incompatible with grazing. Oh. Maybe it was still grazing. But here we've got a fairly small sauropod with this weird wide face. It made me wonder, is it possible that Nigerosaurus was pursuing a lifestyle like a flamingo? You know? Even if it was predominantly a grazer, did it ever wander into a pool and, like, sift out brine shrimp or whatever?
Do we have remains of those dinosaurs where the ear canal is in inspectable condition? Because I know that the orientation of the inner ear really dictates how these, you know, animals hold their heads.
Well, it dictates how they hold their heads when they're alert, but not when they're feeding necessarily. And even the idea that it dictates how they hold their heads when they're alert, there's a wide error bar on that. So, for example, in birds, that the inner ear, the semicircular canal, when they're just sort of in an alert posture, can be anywhere from 30 degrees above horizontal to 20 degrees below horizontal, depending on the species. So if you look across birds, that's a 50-degree range of error. That's not particularly tight.
Yeah.
Humans are a good example. We typically hold our heads with our horizontal semicircular canal aimed upwards between 20 and 30 degrees above horizontal. So if you took this semicircular canal and said, okay, we got to make that horizontal, for humans, you would get the wrong answer. But even like if you do it for a horse, you'll get the orientation that a horse's head is in when it's just standing there hanging out. You won't get the orientation that its head is in when it's eating.
Right.
Yeah, it would be lovely if the inner ear was the silver bullet for dinosaur head posture, but unfortunately, it's just not. If there's that much variation in the living birds and the living dinosaurs that we have, then there's no reason to suspect that the variation was any less in the extinct dinosaurs.
It's interesting because there is so much that the bones can teach us, but there's so much left to interpretation. It's mind-boggling.
Totally. One thing that I am curious about, and there's probably not going to be a way to know this for sure, but I'm interested in the idea of sauropods as predators.
Really?
Yeah. Because, or, you know, at least as scavengers, loads of animals not only will eat, you know, stones and dirt, as we talked about before, but they'll eat bones. Tortoises are notorious for this. Even my pet turtle, a couple years ago, I had her out in the front yard and she was crawling around and I saw her munching on something. It looked like a wadded up napkin. And I went over to see what it was. And it was the skull of a rat.
Wow.
My cat had killed a rat and left it in the front yard. And the skull had sort of gotten down among the shoots of grass and had been out there for months, you know, getting weathered. And the turtle had found it and she was breaking off pieces of bone and swallowing them. Now, if you're a really big animal and you have to make lots and lots of eggshells every year because you're duking out hundreds of babies, probably you have high calcium demands.
Yeah.
One thing I've wondered about is for turtles in particular. Let's say that you're a sauropod and you need a quick hit of protein and calcium and you see a turtle. All you have to do is stomp on that thing and basically you've got nachos.
No kidding. Yeah, that is interesting to think because my tortoise does weird stuff like that all the time too. And I just think, oh, what an idiot. But but I'm sure he's probably out there feeling it out and being like, yeah, I need some of this in my diet, I need some of that. So yeah, that would be interesting to see, and this is, you know, a pipe dream, but if one day a complete, whether it's a manageable size sauropod, if they find other animal bones in its digestive tract.
Oh, I would love to find some acid-etched turtle shell pieces inside the ribcage of a sauropod. That would be brilliant. Because a lot of people don't realize how carnivorous plant-eating animals are today. So, like, deer are notorious for eating baby birds. If deer find a nest, whether it has eggs or baby birds in it, they will eat that. Squirrels kill chipmunks all the time and eat the chipmunks. So he's like, adorable squirrels we've got running around the trees. We think they're our friends, and all they want to do is, like, find an acorn. No, they're murder machines. If they find an animal that's smaller than them and they can kill it and eat it, they absolutely will. Because why wouldn't they? If you mostly eat plants, then calcium and protein are wonderful for you when you can get them. Of course you're going to kill things and take advantage of that resource when you can. You're not going to pass that up.
That is something I never even hit upon, of course, because everyone always thinks, well, you know, cows and all these other modern day contemporary large herbivorous animals are just eating nonstop because they're nutrient poor food. And that was always something that stuck in my craw, is where's all the calcium and the protein coming from? And if you're in nature and you find yourself in a windfall of a rich source of either of those, I'm sure you would capitalize on it.
Exactly.
That is interesting.
I am entranced by the idea that dinosaurs must have been doing at least all of the weird stuff that we see around us in the ecosystem today, and probably even weirder stuff that we really can't imagine because we've never seen it. So I think for more paleontologists and more dinosaur enthusiasts to get acquainted with all the weird stuff that modern animals actually do is crucial. Because then when you see a piece of paleo art where there's, you know, a Styracosaurus chomping on a dead Tyrannosaur, you won't think, oh, hey, that's wrong, it was a plant eater. You'll think, oh, hey, that's actually pretty reasonable, because if a deer will eat a baby bird...
In nature, it's catch as catch can, so if it's there, man, I'm sure.
Exactly, and if you're a horned dinosaur and your beak is basically an immense pair of scissors and you can crunch through just about anything, yeah.
I am just... This is opening up whole new vistas.
I think ceratopsians would have been terrifying. I would not want to be on the ground around a ceratopsian because I'm pretty sure a duckbill is just going to be like a big dumb bird, and as long as I'm not too threatening,
right,
then it's not going to be a problem. But a ceratopsian has horns, and probably, you know, big animals that have horns today are not noted for their calm dispositions.
Exactly.
Things like Cape buffalo and rhinos will go out of the way to attack things just because they can. And then you add a beak on that thing that's like the snapping turtle from hell. I want nothing to do with that, because yeah. I can't trust that Triceratops isn't going to snip me in half just for the protein boost that it's going to get.
Yeah, and you hear, like, let's say, to pull a name out of a hat, Jack Horner again, where he says, you know, oh, the worst place for a defensive mechanism is on your head.
The modern world would absolutely disagree with you.
Yeah, when he said that, it was on some documentary I watched recently, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Well, let's see, we've got warthogs and pigs of all kinds. We've got elephants, if we're talking about using teeth.
Yeah.
If we're talking about horns, we've got all of the bovids and rhinos. Mammals seem to evolve weaponry on their heads at the drop of a hat. I would say it's weaponry anyplace else that's weird.
Yeah, the face is the exact place you want them to be.
Yeah. Let's see. It's right up there with all of my sense organs where I can put it exactly where I want it. Yep, I think that's where I'm going to stick my horns.
If you're running around and there's a T-Rex getting up in your face, the Stegosaurus, sure, like, it probably had a pretty agile tail and could whip it around, but its head is completely just out in the open.
Yeah.
And like, that's what you see, like, because not many, to my knowledge anyway, not many Stegosaurids were as successful as the Ceratopsians.
That's an interesting question. I wonder how much of that is just sort of the taphonomic lottery, where we have had we've had these big herds of ceratopsians preserved. In fact, I even wonder how much social behavior plays into it. So let's say that you're an animal that's, I don't know if stegosaurs are solitary or not. Let's say for argument's sake that at least some of them were. Mm. If you're solitary and you cross a river and you drown, there's going to be one skeleton buried.
Right.
If there's a herd of 1,000 ceratopsians and they try to cross a river and a dozen of them drown, then there's going to be a dozen of them buried, not because there's necessarily more in the environment, but because they were together. Does that argument hold up? If there were just as many stegosaurs, they'd be crossing the river just about as often. I don't know. I still think you'd find these big accumulations more often for the social dinosaurs, and that may skew our perception.
Yeah, in the centrosaur beds in Canada where Philip Curie pulled all those remains out of. That was, you know, a huge crossing that all got washed away. And we find the same things with Pachyrhinosaurus up in Alaska. A bunch of them will be crossing a river. They all drowned. And then there are these huge bone beds that are picked apart by carnivorous dinosaurs. But I can't think of a single instance where someone has found a dearth of stegosaurid remains.
I don't know of any. I wonder if that's a genuine loss or if we just haven't found them yet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we knew about ceratopsians for about a century before we found those big bone beds. So it may be that the stegosaur bone beds are still out there waiting to be found. If they do get found, I predict that it's going to be in China, because they seem to have had more stegosaurs, at least a greater diversity of stegosaurs than we did here in North America.
That's like the bummer crapshoot about stuff, is you're like waiting for the earth to reveal a fraction of an inch of bone so someone can wander by and be like, oh, what's that? And then dig it up.
Yeah, exactly. When we had, we'd go down to Southeast Oklahoma to get these tyrannosaurs. There was a guy down there, Bobby Cross, who trained bloodhounds. And so he'd get out and roam all over training the dogs. And he had a really good eye for bone. If you saw a bone coming out of the ground, he'd give us a call and we'd pile into the truck and go down there. But you never knew what you were going to get.
Right.
Sometimes we'd go down there, it'd be a single toe bone sticking out, and we'd dig around and there'd turn out to be half a tyrannosaur there. And other times we'd go down there, you know, we'd have a bunch of folks in the truck and all the gear that we needed for a 3-day dig. And we'd dig around the toe bone and there would be nothing else. It would just have been that one toe bone. So it's always a crapshoot.
All right, Matt, I got a few rapid fire questions here.
All right. Thanks for indulging me while I spun some flights of fancy.
No, hey, I'm totally into it, because if there is someone out there who's willing to pontificate about the actions of dinosaurs, I am always willing to listen.
Well, I'll link to it. I'll link to when the podcast goes up. I'll link to it from SV Pow, and I will await with great interest the hate mail that I get.
I know most of my fans will find it more boring than anything, but my answer to them is, hey, shut up. Okay, so, are you a cope or a marsh guy?
Cope.
Cope. Why cope?
Oh, actually, no. Sorry. Marsh. This is like the guy in Holy Grail. No, it's Marsh. Okay. And here's why. I actually went and photocopied and read and put online a crap load of Marsh papers when I was at Berkeley. And here's why I'm Marsh. Because Cope was into these grand theories. He had all these ideas about how evolutionary worked, and they were mostly bullcrap.
Right.
And Marsh was just churning out these dry descriptive papers. He wasn't operating as actively in the theoretical realm as Cope was. Mm-hmm. But because of that, Marsh's stuff actually holds up better. You can go read a lot of Marsh's papers and you're like, that's, you know, it's been 140 years now.
Yeah.
And you pretty much nailed it. And there's not very many. I feel like there's fewer of Cope's papers that you can say that about. So although a lot of people are pro Cope because he seems to have been maybe slightly less of a jerk.
Yeah.
In terms of scientific legacy, I got to go with Marsh.
Yeah, because it always seemed to me that Cope had the pedigree of a scientist, whereas Marsh always sort of came off as like a fanboy gone too far.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think Marsh had a lot of structural advantages in his favor, and Cope, I think, definitely had to put in more sweat equity. Mm-hmm. I admire Cope, but just in terms like the narrow, selfish, mercenary, how much can I get out of what they left behind right now myself? I got to go with Marsh.
Nice. All right. So modern day paleontologists, from your Philip Currys to your Paul Serinos, Mark Norell, and of course the patron saints of paleontology, Bakker and Horner. Who is the most interesting paleontologist to you today?
The most interesting today? That's a really good question. Something very timely. Just yesterday, I think, in the news, there's this new ankylosaur.
Yeah, the Zool.
Named Zool.
Yeah.
By Victoria Arbour. She is freaking killing it. Her papers are extraordinarily well done. She illustrates her own stuff. She does a lot of infographics that will help explain the science that she's doing to the public. So in terms of doing killer science and explaining it really well and basically building a career out of just being smart and hardworking and kick ass, I think she's phenomenal.
Very cool.
The limiting it to people that are alive is kind of a bummer for me, because as I was coming up, people that I really looked up to and respected and was fortunate to get to interact with, my sort of holy trinity, was Juan Langston in Texas, Jack McIntosh, who was the dean of sauropod workers, and John Ostrom.
Yeah.
It was that article that he wrote back in 1978 that set me on this path. He came to Oklahoma in the year 2000 for the opening of our new museum building, and I got to be his chauffeur for a week.
That is cool. A lot of paleontologists lay their body of work at the feet of John Ostrom, so it's cool that you got to meet him.
Yeah, and I told him that it was that article that he wrote that set me on that path, and he laughed and said that he, when I met him, I think he was in his early 70s, mm-hmm. and he was slowing down a little bit, but physically, not intellectually. Actually, if you're just sitting in the car talking to him, and you just listen to the enthusiasm and excitement in his voice and didn't look at the little old man sitting next to you, you'd think you were talking to a graduate student. He was so full of energy, so full of ideas. His curiosity and his enthusiasm had not abated one whit. And one of my favorite encounters was he came in the late afternoon. I took him to the museum, showed him around the museum. It was probably like 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. I take him out of the museum. It's dark. And I said, well, John, I'm sure you're tired after your flight. Shall I take you to your bed and breakfast? And he said, well, Matt, I got to ask, is there any place around here where a guy can get a beer? And I was like, yes. So I quit, get on the horn to the other graduate students. I'm like, holy crap. Do you guys want to come out and have a beer with John freaking Ostrom Jesus. Right now? And so a bunch of us grad students went out and had beer with John Ostrom like at 10:30 at night. After he had flown from the East Coast, by the way, it was phenomenal.
That is so cool.
Yeah. So that I got to meet those guys and interact with them and learn from them. And without fail, every one of them was generous to a fault and excited about the work that I was doing. And there was no sense that it was an elite club or that there was any protectionism going on. They wanted to share. They wanted to see paleontology grow and thrive. And they were doing everything they could to reach down and help the next generation up the ladder. And so now it's really on me, I suppose, to help pay that forward.
Yeah, there are so many paleontologists out there, and most of them are completely unknown by the public at large. And even I, like as a dinosaur fanatic, only know of like the heavy hitters. but I never take an opportunity to bring up Georges Cuvier, my all-time favorite paleontologist, simply because, number one, it's a cool name.
Totally.
Number two, not discovered, obviously, but at least named and codified the mosasaur, one of the most outstanding aquatic reptiles ever.
Totally. Totally. I mean, he was sort of Galileo for comparative anatomy.
Yeah.
The one who really turned it into a science and started codifying the rules and recognizing that there were law-like regularities, that if you eat plants, you're going to have teeth like this, that your form was related to what you did in the environment in a predictive fashion.
Yeah.
That was huge. You know, we still rely on that today, and there's an intellectual tradition extending directly from Cuvier through his students and the people he influenced right up to the modern day.
Yeah, I can't imagine where we would be if, after they pulled that skull out of that quarry, calling it an alligator or a crocodile, if he'd have come by and be like, yep, you nailed it, see ya, like, where would we be now?
We'd be a little behind. Somebody else would have done it. There would have been another genius, but, you know, maybe we'd be two or three decades behind where we are now. The whole sequence in which we discovered things completely fascinates me, because I wonder, how different would our picture of dinosaurs be if we had discovered all the feathered dinosaurs and the fuzzy cetacosaurs in Liaoning, not in the early 2000s, but in the 1840s?
I can't imagine.
What if the very first thing out of the gate is we start finding all these feathered dinosaurs, and they've got teeth and they've got claws, but they're totally covered in feathers, so obviously they're birds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find something like cetacosaurus, and we're like, whoa, that is an effed up looking bird, but it still has this fuzzy crap on it. And it's just a little bit weirder than these other ones, so it must be some kind of bird, too. I think had we found Liaoning back in the 1840s, the word dinosaur wouldn't even exist.
No.
We would just realize that there was this weird diversity of extinct birds.
And I also, sometimes the thought occurs to me, like, that the people who name dinosaurs, I wonder if they kick themselves when something different comes. Like, let's take, for instance, the Megalosaurus. I'm sure the guy who named that thought, fuck yeah, this is the biggest thing there ever was, and I'm going to name it like that. And then, you know,
totally.
The T-Rex comes along, and like, or when the Brachiosaurus came out, and I remember when I was a kid, the news of the Ultrasaur.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, oh man, that's definitely the biggest. And I wonder if that guy is like sitting at his desk with a model of an Ultrasaur being like, shit. And like looking over at the Argentinosaurus, the Dreadnoughtus, or whatever, like, it just tickles me to think that these people are like, yep, this is the biggest, nailed it. And then like a year later are like, their hopes are dashed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think that you would not want to name a dinosaur based on a superlative.
No.
Because it's pretty much a guarantee that somebody's going to go find something that's bigger or meaner or faster.
Right.
Or, I am, having gotten in on the naming of a few dinosaurs, the whole process to me is both fun and fascinating, and I like to talk to other people about how they come up with the names for their dinosaurs. Yeah, it's just it's an interesting little side light in paleontology, how dinosaurs get their names.
It also, not only does it brings in, like, you know, human fallibility, but it also, like, the names are, you know, grabbing, you know, your attention. So I can see why they did it, and it definitely was a winning strategy.
Yeah. So to toot my own horn, we've already talked about Sauroposeidon and Aquilops. The third one that I got in on the naming of was Brontomerus, and that's another sauropod. That was 2011, I think. And the name etymologically means thunder thigh.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of good press out of that. But that all came about because Randy Ermus, who was in Kevin Padian's lab at Berkeley at the same time I was, he had just named a little proto-dinosaur Dromomeron, which means running thigh. And so I had the idea that Mirus or Miron, that construction was thigh in my head. And Mike Taylor, who's my co-author on that, we'd always liked Brontosaurus, even before Brontosaurus was officially brought back.
Right.
We're like, if we get a chance, we got to have some kind of Bronto something or other.
It's a great name.
Yeah, totally. I was on the phone with Sarah Werning, who was also in the Padian lab, and we were talking about Dromomeron and what a cool name it was. And I was talking about the problem that I was having coming up with a name for Mike and I. The dinosaurs that I've been in on the naming, the one that finally makes it stands on top of a pile of second-rate crappy names that never see the light of day.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So Mike and I had really been racking our brains to try to come up with a decent construction for this thing. And I was like, hey, wait, Brontomerus would be thunder thigh. And then it just sort of crystallized. And I was like, all right, we're going to roll with that.
I love hearing stories like that. So my next and last question, like, what is your next project? Is there something in the works? Have you discovered something that is working on a name? Where is the immediate future for you?
There are several things that I'm pursuing, and some of them I can say more about than others. There's a paper that I desperately need to get back to, a manuscript that I'm working on with some colleagues, comparing the largest sauropods and the largest whales, and really trying specimen by specimen to say, for both the sauropods and the whales, all right, this is how big this thing was, this is how we know, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, here's a specimen number, and try to put the comparison of these largest animals on a more sort of firm foundation of evidence, and to make it sort of like a one-stop shop. Like, if you're interested in big sauropods and big whales, this paper is going to have all the specimens, it's going to have all the measurements, it's going to tell you exactly what you need.
Interesting.
And of course, as soon as we publish this, people are going to go out and find bigger stuff.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
But that's the way it goes, and I'll be happy when that happens. I'm doing field work right now at sites in southern Utah and in the Oklahoma Panhandle, and in neither case are we probably going to have anything ready to go for another year or two at least. But there's interesting stuff coming out of the ground in both places. One thing that's out there that's has never received a proper description that I keep picking away at and I want to do more with is the giant Apatosaurus, or maybe giant Brontosaurus, from the Oklahoma Panhandle, because it's huge. It's about a third again the size of the big Apatosaurs in New York and Yale and Chicago. It's a real monster, and it's never been adequately described or sort of the implications of that explored.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how that turns out, but I'm interested in everything that comes out regarding dinosaurs, so it's hard to parse.
Yeah, so I'm happy because I've got a good diversity of things going on. I'm frustrated because right now I have so many things going on that it's basically just a question of which co-authors am I disappointing today, because everything that I work on means like five other things that I'm not working on. But it never ceases to be stimulating and enjoyable and fascinating and kind of like a drug.
Yeah, I get that. So, Matt, aside from people going out and buying your book, Life in the Age of Giants, The Sauropod Dinosaurs, which I cannot recommend enough, where can people go to either read about you, or are you on social media? What's the situation there?
So, I don't tweet. The world does not need any more outlets for me to make a fool of myself in, so I'm not on Twitter.
I know that for sure, because I was looking for you on Twitter to be like, hey, everybody, this guy's coming up, but then I couldn't find you, so I'm like, I'll just bring it up later.
I already have enough places to shoot my mouth off, and frankly, I'm too busy to be tweeting. I have blogs, so svpow, svpow.com, Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week. Mike and I and Darren started way back in 2007. Actually, it'll be our 10-year anniversary in a few more months.
Wow.
And for the first 2 or 2.5 years, we actually did get up a fresh new picture of a sauropod vertebra every week. As it started out as a complete joke. We're like, hey, we should do something like Astronomy Picture of the Day, only a sauropod vertebrae. Only once a day is way too rigorous a schedule. Let's do it every week.
Right.
And so for starting out as a complete joke, it evolved into a really important way for us to engage with people directly.
That's awesome.
And at this point, we've put so many resources on there in terms of images and write-ups and things like that, that we can go mine when we're doing presentations and papers. So go check us out there. Trawl through the archives. There'll be pictures of animal dissections and all kinds of weird stuff.
That is definitely going in my bookmark tab.
I have this whole other thing that I do in amateur astronomy. I'm a stargazer. I write for Sky and Telescope magazine. And I have another blog called 10 Minute Astronomy at WordPress, where I blog about stargazing and telescopes. And then I have a third blog, Echo Station 5-7, which is for role-playing games and fish tanks and all my other veins of geekery that aren't about dinosaurs or stargazing.
I think we can get together on the fish tanks, that's for sure.
Yeah, come hit me up at one of those places. The comment threads are open. I would love to hear from people.
Awesome. Okay, perfect. So, Matt, thank you so much for agreeing to be on my show.
Hey, thanks for having me. This has been great. I think I've gotten to spin out pretty much every unfounded ludicrous idea in my head. So,
hey, that's what I do every week. So you're in good company.
I feel cleansed.
So, Matt, I hope to have you back on when more shit arises to the top and we can dive into this a little more. But I got to say, like, your book completely fascinating. I'll be poring over it for days to come, maybe months or years. I'm blown away by everything that is going on in modern day paleontology. And, you know, from someone who wants to but is too dumb to, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you kindly. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm really glad you're enjoying the book. And I got to point out that a lot of the credit goes to Mark Hallett. He definitely earned his first authorship. And that book had been a gleam in his eye since the 90s at least. I knew who he was from the time I was 9 years old because I was seeing his art in dinosaur books. So that I got to grow up and meet him and then collaborate with him and complete a project that had been a dream of his for so long is beyond satisfying.
I can't sing his praise enough. It's amazing. And if you like dinosaurs at all, get one. I'm going to have to get one for my nephew as soon as he is old enough not to destroy it. So you'll get another chunk out of me. So to everybody listening, please check out Matt's work and everybody else who he has mentioned, even the people he hasn't. Like, get into dinosaurs, goddammit. The more people who like them, the more money gets thrown at it, the more we learn. So please,
yeah, do it. If you're every one of those names I dropped deliberately. Those people are all doing amazing work. Go check them out.
Yeah,
enrich your life.
So thanks for listening to this very special bonus episode of FFOB Radio, and we'll catch you next time. Bye bye.
Fistful of Podcasts Radio.